You are listening to a session from the Sunstone 2013 Salt Lake City Symposium at the University of Utah. This particular session was recorded on August 1st, 2013, and is titled, We Are Daughters of Our Heavenly Father Who Loves Us, Empowering Young Women in the LDS Community. Presented by Chelsea Archibald, Chelsea Strayer, Jessica Steed, and Dan Christensen. Sunstone depends on your generous support to fund projects like this podcast and other important endeavors in Mormon culture, scholarship, and restorationist pursuits. Please consider a donation at sunstonemagazine.com.
Welcome to session 154. We are Daughters of Our Heavenly Father Who Loves Us, Empowering Young Women in the LDS Community. Just a couple of reminders. We would like everyone to silence their cell phones and other noisemakers before the session begins. I don't know what other noisemakers you might have, but silence those. And I'm here to introduce the speakers. We have some really great speakers for this panel today. Jessica Oberen-Steed has a BA in political science from BYU. She blogs at Exponent 2 and is a board member of LDS WAVE, Women Advocating for Voice and Equality. Dan Christensen is proud to be two-spirited. Dan helps his daughters embrace their creativity while their mother's lessons have included athletics and administration. His own acute lesson, in common with many LDS women, involves finding one's life despite our culture's shoulds. Speaking of which, Dan recently deflected a shaming comment about settling for ministering angel status from someone in the ward where he serves as a musician, high priest instructor, and chair of Fabulous Socials. Dan Christensen's most obvious credential for the panel is parenting. For the past 3 decades, 2 daughters and 2 sons. He made a good start on the next generation, too, shown here cutting out paper dolls for his granddaughters. He grew up in Logan, Utah, where a state school awarded him BA in journalism and music. Salt Lake City is his home now, where another one bestowed an MA in March in architectural design. Is that correct?
In March.
Active in the original 13th Ward, and he blogs at diamondsinthedumpster.wordpress.com. Chelsea Shields Strayer is an anthropology PhD candidate at Boston University and recently moved to Utah. She is the president of Mormons for ERA, a founding member of LDS WAVE, a blogger at Exponent Magazine, Mormon Matters, and other feminist organizations.
Okay, so welcome. We're excited you're here. There's going to be plenty of time and for you guys to discuss. When you have questions or comments, you might want to stand up. We don't necessarily have a microphone for you, but you might want to stand up and make a comment. The way that this is going to go today is I'm going to kind of give you an introduction of what we want to talk about. Then we're going to go through these same topics, these same 5 bullet points for particular topics. Okay, so our bullet points are, what are some of the destructive messages that our young women hear on a regular basis? What are the problematic norms and assumptions that those messages inculcate to our young women? How can we empower them within the church? What challenges face these young women? And the final thing is specific resources and ideas. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the topics of modesty, bodies, chastity, attractiveness and attraction, careers, life choices, and marriage. We're going to kind of go over all of these messages per topic. Now, each of us prepared specific examples, stories, messages, etc. at the end of each section. So, for example, at the end of modesty, we're going to open it up for about just a quick, you're dying to make a comment, you don't want to wait till the very, very end. You're probably going to take 2 or 3 comments per topic, and at the very end, we'll just open it up. Okay? So, how we're going to start, I'll kind of be the one to moderate a little bit. We're going to start with modesty. And the first question on modesty is, what are some of the destructive messages that our young women hear? And I'm going to just go down the aisle. Jessica, me, and Dan, and we're just going to kind of cover for a while. After we get to our 5 bullet points, then I'll open it up to 2 minutes of questions.
Can you hear me? Okay, I had a thought about modesty this morning. Really, to try to teach young children about being modest can end up being more... There can be more negative messages being sent. Because to say, especially to a very young child, this is not good, to show this part of your body. You know, don't show your shoulder. That shouldn't even be on their radar at that age. And it can be a shaming thing, a way of judging one another, separating them from their friends. And I had the thought, instead of talking about modesty, why not talk about or teach them more social skills? How do you want, what kind of people do you want to interact with, and how are you reflected in them? And then they'll just end up dressing the way that, you know, for their goal. Or so what do you think about that? Just focus on social skills. Actually, with my own daughters, they're both very conservative. And so I say my secret for that was to be a little bit wild myself. I'd say, well, why don't you wear this? And they, oh, no, Dad, I could never wear that. And once I found a whole bunch of denim miniskirts, $1 each. So I bought one for my high school. My daughter was in high school. I said, well, you could wear it with leggings. And she said, no, it's too hoochie. So give them the option. I mean, to me, it hasn't been an issue. I think it's finally.
So has anybody read the Feminist Mormon Housewives 4-part series by Star Foxy on modesty? If you haven't, if you are at all interested or have had a discussion like I had in the last few days with my old college roommates about modesty that ended terribly, we talked past each other for like 30 minutes. It's very excellent. The first 3.5 parts, everything she says about modesty can apply equally to men and women, which I think is a great place to start. And then in her last section, which I think is most critical here, she talked, one thing she says is that women's bodies are the personification of sex. And whenever you say it in media, you say sex sells, and it's always emphatically or naked woman's body. That's what you talk about. And I really like this section. She talks about the male gaze and the female mood. And I actually read this quote in Katrina's session this morning. But John Berger, who's an art critic, had a TV series called Ways of Seeing, and he said that to be naked is to be seen and recognized as oneself. And if you haven't seen Katrina's website called Mormon Women Bear, you should see that as beautiful. To be without pretense or disguise, however to you, just to be seen naked yet not recognized as oneself. To have the skin and hair of the body become a disguise. And what's worse, it is a disguise that cannot be discarded. The female nude will never be more than an object of male desire. Now, I don't know if this is true for everyone, this is one person's opinion, but as we see with the Mormonism of very young women, a lot of time that's the message that they're getting, that their bodies are something to be desired. And also somewhat feared. I see this tension a lot, that if a girl, a woman comes to church and she's wearing a short skirt or a low-cut blouse, the young men in her class feel that they can go to their church leaders and point to her and say, she's a problem. I can't sit by her because she's distracting me in her immodest clothing. And that's something that we have to control, these messages. This is a story one of my college roommates told me about 2 days ago. And they all thought that that was very valiant for these young men to be kind of tattling on their girl in their class. And I really was shocked, and I had such a hard time articulating why I thought that was damaging. And then when I read this, the next part that Star Foxy talks about, she says, the female body is the symbol of sex. Individual women in their daily lives are seen but not recognized as themselves. They're viewed as symbols or archetypes of the various ways we categorize female sexuality. And then she lists some of the archetypes: the whore, the angel, the crone, the siren, the succubus, the harridan, the glutton, the wife, the mother, the child. And so we exchange archetypes and pretend to be them, but we are more than these archetypes. And so sometimes we try to be the archetype that's closest to us, but it's never going to be exactly us. And sometimes we want, and especially being a woman, we want them to be the asexual archetypes. And then, of course, we're surprised when they get married and the two things that we want them to be, a wife and mother, they're required to actually be sexual. And so they have to switch up this archetype without much preparation, without much training. And I think that there's so much to this notion of how we teach modesty in Mormonism that's really, really damaging, but a lot of it comes down to how we see women as the personification of sex.
My comments might be a little more anthropological, but I want us to do the first two. What are some of the destructive messages in everyone here, and why are these problematic? What are the problematic norms and assumptions? And I think this takes me back to the concept of what a rape culture is, what a modesty culture is. Now, let me just describe what those two things are, and then we'll get into how it applies to LDS theology or praxis. So what a rape culture is where rape is assumed to be normal. It happens. And in its normalization, the victim is the one who is not anonymous, but the perpetrator is anonymous. We know the victim. She has to defend her. It's a crime, a trial. The victim is on trial. Her sexual behaviors are on trial. Whether she's promiscuous is on trial. What she was wearing is on trial, right? Not necessarily the perpetrator. And that's what a rape culture is. That's normal. It's normal in our country. And 95% of people accused of rape do not see present time. It's normal in our country to see a New York Times article the next day describing what the woman wore the day she was raped. Now, why? Some of you might be like, oh, yeah, that happened. Because it's an assumption you have in a break. Well, yeah, girls should dress differently. Why that's a problem, why that makes us, the United States, not necessarily just Mormonism, a rape culture is the rape occurred when a male decided to use his overt physical strength against a woman's will. That is the end of what the rape was. Now, what she wore had nothing to do with his decision to take over that, to steal something from her, to do that action. But in a rape culture, what the victim is, who she is, what she does, what she wears counts. Does that make sense? So we see a similar thing with a modesty culture, where women become the gatekeepers of male sexuality. They themselves are either overtly sexual, the saint or the whore, right? So in an Islamic rendering of a modesty culture, women are so sexual that we need to cover them and keep them in the hijab and the burqa and to protect their sexuality. In the Mormon culture, it's quite the opposite. In the Mormon culture, it's not that women are too sexual. It's that men are so sexual, so visually stimulated that you need to keep yourself covered to control his sexuality. So in a modesty culture, women become these gatekeepers of sexuality. The child's body, the female body, becomes the symbol of sexuality for the whole culture. And I think people who kind of sporadically view Mormon feminism, contemporary Mormon feminism behind, like, why aren't you talking about modesty so much? But this is why. It's a microcosm of how we treat and see women. So what are some of the problematic norms and assumptions? Well, part of it is that my body does not belong to me. I don't wear what I want when I want, and modesty doesn't mean wearing the appropriate attire for the appropriate activity. Right? That's in the terms. That's what modesty means. That's not what it's come to mean in our culture. What it's come to mean is how I dress can be communicated about by other people, can be good or bad as judged by other people, has nothing to do with me. I can be in trouble. I can be kicked out of activities. How a dress becomes a cultural, enormous significance about who I am inside, what my worth is. I mean, how often do we hear in conference, the Lord looks on the heart, but they use that same scripture to say, so dress modestly, right? So we have this kind of double speak in the church. One of the other reasons why it's a problematic thing, and I'll just take maybe three or four more things because I'm sure everyone wants to talk more, is why can we talk and teach modesty from a male gaze, which is we have to be careful because males are visual creatures, and immediately desexualizes the female. What that says is I'm not wearing clothes because I want to show off my body because I'm a sexual being. We don't talk about the opposite. So let's think about the converse, right? And because there's a lot of men here, like, but what men are visual creatures, right? But you do trigger our visual brains. So let's think about the opposite. Women are oral creatures. We're literary creatures. What about the Harley Quinn romances? They make millions of dollars because we like it, okay? And how often do we hear young men being told regularly, now men, don't sext or text women because they get really turned on by words. I mean, they just don't hear things like this, right? We don't teach them all to be nice and friendly. Don't give women too much attention or be attentive because that really turns them on. Because we don't do the opposite. And women are still the gatekeepers. There's a million other problematic things that we can do. I'm going to open it up a little bit to these two to talk about more problematic things, and then we all have suggestions. But okay, well, how do we teach it? What do we do? So I'm just going to open up to these guys if there's any more problematic assumptions that they have.
Well, in regard to the church, this is probably just old-fashioned, nitpicky. But so often when someone is sitting on the stand, we'd like to welcome Brother so-and-so and his lovely wife. That's just objectifying her, giving her one role. And this even happened in the international meeting a few weeks ago. How many of you listened to that leadership training that was broadcast all over the world? The apostle who's conducting, there were cameras focused on a mission, a stake, a branch, a ward, around the world. When he only acknowledged one woman, in these different pictures that were being shown, he said, "Oh, President so and so, you're looking good," which I thought meant we can see you, which I think was part of the meaning. We can see you on this camera. Then he said, "But Sister so and so, you're looking better," and that just struck me wrong.
And we are going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the idea of attraction and what the female role in the LDS culture is to be attractive, what that means, and kind of...
I can't think of one more problematic and destructive message. It just, it's so bizarre to me that... Has anyone heard modest is hottest?
Yes.
Where is this coming from? What does it even mean? That popped in my head and it makes me crazy.
Sexy modest.
So
here's what's interesting about modesty, and I'm sure this is repetition for a lot of you, but the idea of modest is hottest is no matter what you do, if you focus on modesty, you're sexualizing something. No matter what you do, you're saying modest is hottest. You're saying that, like, the woman's role is to be hot, right? And as a work folk, and if you're not, you know, even if they're modest or not, you're constantly looking at the woman's body and the woman's clothing as a measure of who she is. And we do as sexual identity. And what we do too is, in our culture, this strict understanding of modesty allows us, and I'm sure everyone in here, raise your hand if you've never judged someone for wearing sleeveless or a bikini, or we are enculturating children to look at someone and judge them based on the outward appearance. It even goes further than this. One of my stories and examples I have with my mother, who was state camp director, and she had to send women home because they had too short of shorts or sleeveless. And I just was so upset by this. We had a big debate about it. And I said, here are youth choosing to donate, you know, to put a week of their time in a church activity, and you are barring them based on the shirt they're wearing or the pants they're wearing or whatever. And it's not like they were overtly sexual or with bad graphics. They didn't have long enough sleeves or long enough shorts. And I said, do you not see how unchristlike that is? Do you not see how wrong that is? And why this story is problematic for me in a couple ways is First of all, that we're doing that to women, what you wear, we're focusing on that rather than inward spirituality. But secondly, my mom felt like she had zero power. She said, well, the state president told me I have to do it. And so not only is it coming down from above as a masculine directive, but my mom felt like she had no say in her own body, in her own modesty, and how to teach modesty, and how to, it was, I'm being obedient, and that obedience trumped rational thinking about the topic of whether a girl should be allowed to go to a girls' camp. Now let's talk about some positives. I'm sure a lot of you will come up with more problematic assumptions. For me, and I'll open it up, for me, one of my best positives in my own life was when, I'll give you an example around that, when I was taught be modest, it just kind of made me angry and made me super judgy. I was very self-righteous. I would say the wrong bikini and all the good, warm guys of life. I'm like, that's not fair. I've been really modest my whole life. You should like me. Right? Like, it was this weird self-judgy thing. And I didn't really like the way it was taught. Until the woman there taught me, you should dress modest because you are a goddess. She taught it from this position of power. You are incredible. You are powerful. You should dress that way. And it wasn't dress modest. It was you should dress because you're powerful and you want people to see you and not just see cleavage and see you and not just see body parts. You want them to see you. And it was the first time I really thought, oh, I need to be self-reflective about the way I dress, because no matter what I wear, as an anthropologist, it's so true, I'm communicating things about who I am. And this is how I try to teach young women when I teach. I give them this, I play this game called What If. I say, what if I came, and I do this with some of my one-on-one anthology classes, you know, a room of one-on-one anthology. What if I came to class today wearing a cocktail dress and a short and a cleavage? What would you think of me? Immediately. Well, I don't think you're very competent. Teacher. I would think you were out all last night. Okay, what if I came to class dressed in a dowdy, you know, whatever. Well, I think that you're kind of scattered, you don't care about clothes. Okay, what if I came to class in a total safari gear? Well, we would think this. And we go through all the different variations of clothing that I can wear. What if I came in sweats like all my students? Well, we think you didn't care so much. And I try to say that to my students. What we wear communicates a lot about our competency, about what we care, what we care about, what we think, who we are. You can't eliminate the fact that you're communicating things by what you wear. We can't get rid of that. Okay? We've evolved to communicate to each other, so we don't have to meet someone and start back at the beginning. We have stereotypes for a reason. They're useful. They help us understand and know someone very quickly. And so I think if we started teaching young women about the power of cultural symbols, about self-examination, go out, wear in hospitals, see how people treat you and talk to you, how does that feel? Now wear this, how does that feel? And allow them to self-investigate how people respond to what they look like. It's quite a different way to teach modesty than we've done so far. So that's kind of how I would, we can empower you.
I was going to say the same thing, and I think as leaders or parents of young women, we have to expect that they're going to make mistakes, and they might wear something, and if we're open and say, you know, I think that looks beautiful, how do you feel? Do you feel confident in that? You know, how did you like it when the priests looked at you? What about when their fathers looked at you? You know, like how, or their grandfathers? Like, you just have to ask these questions, because you might get the attention from the people you want, and you might get attention from people you don't want. So that's something that, some days that's fine, and other days it's not, and as long as we're telling these young women that it's their bodies and their choices, and we're going to love and support them no matter what, and they'll grow up and have healthy behaviors.
But to focus on it that much, I mean, I would rather my daughters or my sons just not evaluate that much. I mean,
but that's impossible in church currently. Because it's taught so often.
And that's our premise.
So the question is, if our daughter loves, for example, I'm in primary, we had a class on modesty in junior primary, when there were pictures, and I'm not lying, I'm telling you the exact story, of Dennis Rodman. And they said, they're showing pictures of everybody, is it modest or not, and the class had to vote. So Dennis Rodman, is he modest? Everyone said, no, and my husband spoke up, well, he's a basketball player. So it's okay that he's wearing athletic gear. Well, he has tattoos. So no, he can't be modest. So we spent the whole day. This is the kicker, right? She put a baby. A baby in a full three-piece suit. Is this baby modest or not? That's just yes. And in the back of the room, I'm sitting there thinking, how can a baby be modest? So this is what we mean by, yes, it'd be awesome if it just never had to be talked about. But it's being, that this generation of children is being talked about at such a high rate about this topic of modesty that us as women and mothers and new ones, we have to figure out a way to combat it. I think the ideal is not have to, but we do have to.
Well, and so you're talking about processing this information at home and dealing with the damage that was done at church, basically.
Or giving young leaders around the world a better network or frame in which to teach these things. You know, a better... And maybe a lot of people are benevolently modesty culture or benevolently religious culture. They're not trying to hurt their women. They want the best intentions. They want the young women to be happy. But they don't have a framework by which to see harmful or damaging assumptions.
Okay.
Now we're going to take just 5 minutes. Open your mouth. This is the kind of the end of what we're talking about with modesty. Our next section is on bodies. So stand up and talk really loud. Kind of comments, questions, stories, etc.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
So yesterday I did a shame workshop here. As I was getting ready for it, I had the trailer for the documentary Misrepresentation that I was watching, and it talks a lot about, you know, how there's just no emphasis on what's going on in our girls' brains, or it's just all about the looks and all the energy that girls spend. And then I was also looking at the media that we get from our church, and I came across one of the media messages for young women, and it's called 195 Dresses. And the girl has arranged like a little boutique out of the State Center that they have 195 modest dresses that the girls can come for prom and just do their get their dress, which quite frankly is a fantastic idea on lots of levels. But it was really interesting for me to see those completely juxtaposed next to each other. It was like, she's doing this for her personal project, personal progress project. She's spending so much of her life energy dress and not on her career and not on her relationships with her. I mean, and maybe she does it other ways, but it just was going sort of on and on and on. My perspective on this is that to be able to get to a place where we can reach our anti-modest, hottest rhetoric, we also have to acknowledge that it is that the people that are doing it, she kind of alluded to this, that they're doing it in response to the sort of misrepresentation crap that we're seeing. That they're really trying to do it, and so we need to make sure that when we're trying to promote this anti-modesty rhetoric, if that makes sense, that it's we're coming from common ground, that we really are trying to treat our girls with the love and kindness that they deserve from the inside, so that we can at least then move people forward to where we're going.
I totally agree. That was at the end of Star Foxy's post. She says the summary is stop talking about their clothing and give them something important to do. Like that's what it's down to.
I have a question. So you talked about teaching young women. How do we teach young men so that their attitudes are different?
Yes. Well, since I have 3 boys, and none of them is 11, I was actually thinking about what Chelsea said, how, you know, when I was younger, I would judge everybody, and now my idea of modesty is different, and I'm fashionable, and I do wear a cape, and I put one on the other day, and my son was like, Mom, that is beautiful. And I was so proud, because I thought, you know, when I was little, it didn't matter what color or fat, you know, that it would have been bad, and that person who wore it would have been bad. And I'm glad that my boys don't have that kind of damaging thing. And whether they choose to, you know, grow up and date a woman who wears whatever, that's fine with me, but they won't see this and think something bad.
I'm so glad Margaret brought this up, because the way to teach someone out of a modesty culture or out of a rape culture is instead of putting all the focus on women, you have to educate the boys. Okay? So you have to educate a boy that clothing is not a symbol of sexual availability. Now, modesty for men is similar, older. Man with his shirt off, it can be a symbol of sexual availability. But by and large, when we go to a club, when we're off campus, what a man wears does not signal sexual availability. However, what a woman wears, we think, signals sexual availability. So you have to talk to to boys and educate that clothing does not signal that. Because a woman's dressing modestly, it says nothing about her sexual availability or desire for you or for sex or anything. You have to talk to a woman, see him as a whole person. One of the things that's fascinating is studies do show the younger you talk to your children, especially males, about pornography, bodies, objectification, modesty, the clearer they see it. If you talk to your boys at 4 and 6 and say, look, when we look at pornography, we're objectifying this woman based on just her body, not seeing who she is or whatever. Kids are a little bit more black and white. Like, oh, okay, I don't show my privates. I shouldn't look at their privates. It's kind of a clear black and white thing. When we teach our sons 10 to 13, they're at a very curious age. So anything I tell my son 10 to 13, he can say, oh, I need to look that up later. Right? It's quite a different response to the idea of bodies and sexuality and modesty dependent on the developmental age of your child. So, I mean, you would have to just teach it differently at 10 to 13 if you hadn't done that previously. But Margaret is absolutely right that to get over modesty culture is to educate our sons that women are not the gatekeepers of sexuality. That a woman can wear anything, you can be naked, lying on the ground in a sexually suggestive pose, and that says nothing about you and your actions and what you should and cannot do. We also have a big problem with consent. That a lot of times, like I said, clothing is a symbol of sexual availability. Men in these age, especially on a college campus where I worked for the last 7 years, men typically have a different concept of what consent is than women. If a woman is drunk, if she's passed out, if she's totally immodest, at what level? Those are symbols of consent to a man. They're not necessarily signals of consent from a woman. Does that make sense? So we have to teach our sons what actual consent for any type of physical contact is. And so there's lots of things we can educate men, and that's kind of the solution to rape culture.
He's a nephew, actually my ex-wife's nephew, posted on Facebook. He just got married, and here was this statement that said, there was a guy sitting there in the picture, and he said, man's job is to respect a woman, down below, a woman's job is to give him something to respect. And so I spoke up. And I had just seen him at the Pioneer Parade, so we were on good terms. And I said, look carefully at this statement. You're giving all the responsibility to the woman for what you're supposed to do, and your only responsibility is to your job. And so we have to speak up. Unfortunately, these ideas are so persistent.
Any other comments about modesty?
This is just about modesty. I did want to say there is also something to empower leaders around the world on how to teach and talk about modesty. It isn't appropriate for older men to be commenting on with young girls' bodies and clothing, and so. There is something, aside from just teaching young women the appropriate way, we also need to start teaching our leaders. Because again, I think a lot of them are benevolent. We mad.
And some of us come to this consciousness later. The fact that we get there is what's important, right? And so I'm saying in a Relief Society meeting, I have a daughter-in-law that was a convert to the church of 1 year, who was an attorney. She's fabulous. And she wasn't from Utah, and she's here, finding herself in the midst of all this culture. And she was wearing pants to church. And she has beautiful pantsuits that she wears because she's an attorney. And to her, that's dressing up. It was wonderful. I'm perfectly fine with it, but I can sense she had to move in my ward because I had watched my grandson since he was born. And
I remember when it was me, I could tell that the sisters were very, very uncomfortable with her coming in and everybody else. And so one day she wasn't there, and I was talking, and they got on that subject, and they said, you know, I explained a little bit about her background and stuff. I said, she's this wonderful person, and she feels like she's dressing up here. No consciousness yet on my part. You see that? I'm justifying. So anyway, somebody said, well, don't worry. As she grows in the gospel, it will distill upon her. Guess when my consciousness hit? And I went, say what? You know, and then I had to repent because I remember thinking in my back life that I had that. Oh, this thing is already grow, and this and this and this. And I just went, oh. I just kept going, and from then on I just thought, you know. And then I talked to her about it afterwards and everything, and she said she was, before they moved where we were, she lived in the ward that meets in the Joseph Smith Memorial, and she was in that ward. She went in for a temple recommend, and she asked the state president, she said, you know, you don't mind that I repent, do you? And he goes, oh, no, it doesn't bother me. He said, I have been noticing something. He says, all the old ladies are wearing pants now because of you. And she said, and then all they can talk about is how warm it keeps them because they're older. You know, so anyway, and it's so practical. It's just so normal. You know, it's just so, she only got it when she came out there, so.
I think two questions on the subject.
Thank you. Just for a couple of examples, yours about the visitor wearing the well-groomed pantsuit, and Jessica, you gave an example of your two-piece bathing suit, mm-hmm. and the compliment from your son. To what extent do we have to take these two examples and to spread that view, the view that we want to convey? That a pantsuit works, that a two-piece bathing suit works, and then to convey that ideology onto our larger community. Rather than keeping it in our own households, do we have a duty to spread that idea? Now, along with doing it, it comes to dialogue to spread the message in the correct way. It might be to wear more pantsuits, whatever they call it, this one, or the word swim party, perhaps you only have two bathing suits. I'm only grabbing these two examples, but we can multiply this out into all other ideas. Or should we simply keep them in our own homes, explain to our own children only, let them know the ideal that we're trying to put forth, and let the larger community simply carry on with their unhealthy views?
Well, how would you propose how would you propose we promulgate these ideas to the larger community? I don't think it's an issue of whether we want to or not. It's how. How do we do it? There's blogs, there's everything.
I could have had a thought about that. Like, I have a comment about your book too. Eliza R. Snow said, this is like, I just love part of this quote from the weird thing. We not only stay because we have the right, but justice and humanity demand that we should.
Wait,
say that again. Slower. Yeah. We not only speak because we have the right, but justice and humanity demand that we should. Eliza R. Snow said that in regards to speaking out about women's rights and their equality. I'm kind of obsessed with her right now. But when you were talking about, you were saying that when women dress like their grandfather, their friend's grandfather's their dads, how would you suggest that we coach or suggest to women that how they should react? Because also women are objectified even when they are dressed modestly. How should we also teach our women how to react to this attention when it's unwarranted or unwanted? You know, someone isn't allowed to, you know, say like, hey, you sure look smoking hot, you know, like even if it's like someone's grandma in like a beehive, like come on.
Interesting that you ask that, because there's this old guy in Reward, and he's the nicest man in the world, and his wife died about 5 years ago, but he makes me uncomfortable, and he pulls me in really tight.
the fact that this kind of actually is a good transition to our section on bodies, like the way, it's the way that in Mormonism and in the culture at large, we see women's bodies as kind of property that everybody is able to touch or talk about or look at.
So we are going to transition to bodies, but in that, for me, I think what's inherent in that is this idea of attraction, attractiveness. So we're kind of about bodies and attractiveness, destructive messages, how health, all that stuff. And I think one of the things, just segueing off this, is if we tell our leaders that their job is to moderate the modesty of the women they have stewardship of, if we tell our leaders that their job is to moderate the chastity lessons of the people they have stewardship of, in so much they can call them and ask them specific questions, comment on their clothing, then we're going to get men who feel like it's, and young men, this first example, who feel like it's their duty, nay, their stewardship or responsibility to moderate women's bodies, sexuality, and attractiveness. How often do we have leaders say, now you single ladies, try to look more attractive, right? How often do we have leaders who feel like it's their mantle to moderate those types of behaviors for women? And I think that that's the inherent problem here, is that they feel like it's their duty. And so we see it in other facets of life where they can comment on that. So as we get into bodies, we're going to start by saying, what are some destructive messages that our young women hear? What are some problematic norms and assumptions in regard to bodies in the church? And then the last thing we'll talk about is how can we empower young women? And then we'll open it up to comments again.
I don't have an example specific to the body, but to gender. My cousin was the first of five children on a small farm, and she's a girl, and her dad kept telling her, we could have made this farm work if you'd been a boy. And she probably worked twice as hard as being a boy, and the farm still wasn't enough to support the settlement of them and the grandparents. So she had this tremendous weight on her shoulders, and it was from being a girl.
That's difficult. I wanted to share a spiritual experience. It seems kind of like an odd place to share it, but this was kind of the story that I was thinking about when I signed up to be on this panel. So I sometimes have a hard time listening for sacrament meeting with just the gendered message that we get just from having all of the men on the stand and praying to an all-male trinity and everything. So a while back, I started repeating the sacrament prayer to myself as they were saying it, and I used the female pronouns. And they even thought of a female savior. And since Jesus sounds a lot like Jessica, that's the name I put in. So I'm going to read it, actually, the way that I read it to myself, and then tell you about one Sunday, specifically, I had some insights about women's bodies after I read this. So, sorry, I'm a little bit nervous. Okay. Oh God, the Eternal Mother, we ask thee in the name of thy daughter, Jessica Krista, to bless and sanctify this bread to the souls of all those who partake of it, that they may eat in remembrance of the body of thy daughter. And witness unto thee, O God, the Eternal Mother, that they are willing to take upon them the name of thy daughter, and always remember her, and keep her commandments. And when I said keep her commandments, I thought, that doesn't sound right. That's not. And then this phrase came into my mind, it was, and love her children, which she has given us, that they may always have her spirit to be with them. Amen. And then the water prayer. Oh God, the Eternal Mother, we ask thee in the name of thy daughter, Jessica Krista, to bless and sanctify this wine or water to the souls of all those who drink of it, that they may do it in remembrance of the blood of thy daughter, which was shed for them, that they may witness unto thee, O God, the Eternal Mother. That they do always remember her, and that they may have her spirit to be with them. And when I repeat those in my head, and not every time, but one time when I was thinking of the bride prayer and the body of a woman, and I thought, what if we did worship a woman? What if we worshiped her body every week at church?
with the female body we see in all of these crazy ways where we have this fear and desire, what society sees as sexualized all the time, and I thought, no, if we had a God the Mother that we worship every single week, an ancient piece of her body in remembrance of her sacrifice, or the sacrifices of all of our mothers, but the sacrifice that his mother made for our children, that was part of our core doctrine, then these issues wouldn't be here. Modesty and bodies and sexuality. I mean, sure, there would be sexuality, but it wouldn't be the kind of thing that made me embarrassed or ashamed or afraid.
Lo and behold, BYU has the highest rates of eating disorders of any college campus. Mormonism, perfectionism, eating disorders go hand in hand. And as a medical anthropologist, you discover that eating disorders are really interesting phenomena, anorexia, bulimia, and disordered eating, that we see it as a culturally specific disease. Did you guys know that? So we call it culture-bound disorder. And what that means is it only persists in certain cultures. The perfect example of the power that culture or social pressure has on physical susceptibility, that our cultural message actually penetrates the skin, the mind, and alter a body. We see that in cultures we have very low, in America, very, very low, almost non-existent examples of African-American women with eating disorders. One of the reasons is there's a culture that praises a voluptuous body. Okay? And why I'm bringing this up is for that whole year at this clinic, my job was to represent healthy eating and healthy body image. And I began to see my body not as, which it was previously, because I was raised in the church in a very traditional way. And my body, this is my experience, was my job as a body is to attract a man, to get dates, to get someone to ask me out, to eventually get someone to ask me to marry him. Like, my body was a magnet by which I would get all of my ordinances. That's the only way I'm going to get that perfect eternal marriage, get that, become in the highest part of the celestial kingdom with my body. It was who I could attract. And so that's kind of how I saw my body up until this year. During this year, I began to have to see my body differently. I had to explain, you know, my body is strong. It's healthy. That's what gives me power. That's what makes me great. Teach these girls that their bodies are more than a symbol of what someone else thinks of them, what the greater culture says of them. And just my last thing is, I wrote this post for Exponent right after I had my first baby. And I said, I'd love to see the temple. And the phrase was, we sing this song all the time. Our kids sing this song all the time. Now, in our bodies, our temples, we've learned them for life. What if Mormon women loved to see the temple? Damn, loved their bodies. And I wrote this whole post about how women leaders, all I remember them talking about their bodies was, oh man, I sure wish I had your body. Oh, I used to have such a great body. Now I've had all these kids and they don't. This is the messages I got from my women leaders. The messages I got from my mother, which is heartbreaking, is, I'm not fulfilling my life and duty. I'm overweight. I had 8 children. She's raised them wonderfully and feels like she's a failure in the Mormon world because she, as a wife, is no longer has a 25-year-old body. That she sees her duty as a Mormon woman to maintain that attractive body and she's not doing it. So these are the messages I got growing up. So I wrote this post on I'd Love to See the Temple. What if there was a world in which Mormon women love to see their temple? And I still had my little baby pooch after I had my kid. I saw my little daughter walking around with her little big fat pooch. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just love my body. Like, it's been through so much, it's done so much, I love it. And what would happen to all the other women if this happened? Utah has the highest rates of female plastic surgery in the nation. So not only are we giving our young women destructive messages about their bodies through all these things we talked about, but our older women are altering their bodies in such a way that the young women don't even know what a body's supposed to look like. And if their body looks different, they think it's bad. So these are all huge problems in assumptions we have with bodies in the church. And I'll say one last thing about attractiveness and attraction, and then we'll get on to, well, what can we do? I've often seen that these issues surrounding attractiveness, bodies, perfection, have a lot to do with, and that you guys might have other ideas up here, but have a lot to do with how we gain prestige. In the church, as a man, you can gain prestige in a multiple way, in multiple outlets. You can gain prestige by having a good career, by making a lot of money, by getting a high calling, right? You can gain prestige by being a great dad. As a female, there's very narrow margins in which you can gain prestige. And it's very narrow ages. So from the age of 16 till marriage, women do get a lot of prestige, a lot of attention, but it's based on dating and attractiveness. Okay? Rarely it's based on career. Rarely it's based on what she thinks. Rarely it's on her schooling, how much money she makes, what college she has. I mean, women rarely have very narrow margins of what's considered worthy of success.
And I have an example. Yeah. I did a survey last month for the priesthood lesson on Relief Society. And a young woman wrote me from Chicago. She said she's actually very career-minded and had all these aspirations, which she never got attention for. But when she got married, I think she was only 18 when she got married, which she didn't necessarily aspire to do, she said, I had so much support and so much affirmation about that in my life. And she said, but I don't have support for these things that really mean a lot to me.
Absolutely.
Oh,
there's a girl in my ward who was 17. She was on the USA soccer team for her age group or whatever. Like, she toured around the US as an amazing athlete. She went on a scholarship playing soccer. And I stopped her in the hall of church once and I said, does everyone in the ward know that you're like a nationally ranked soccer player? And she's like, no. And I said, do you think that if you were a boy and you were a nationally ranked soccer player, the whole world would know? And it was really upsetting to me. And she was so cute. And she's like, I don't want anybody to know. And maybe that's part of it, it's her personality, but there is a narrow range. There's a narrow range.
Well, I was just going to say that it reminded me of when I got into my master's program. I got married when I was 20, so I did all the things I was supposed to do, but then I just never had kids forever. And I told my mom, you know, I passed the GRE, I got this great score, I got into the program I wanted, and she literally looked at me and said, oh, that's great, and then she moved on to the next subject. And that was so hurtful for me. I mean, she didn't mean to, because my mom is not college educated, so she doesn't understand the value and how difficult that is. But then when I finished my master's program, I got a card, because I'm pregnant with my first kid, and I just finished in the spring. And my grandmother sent me a card that said, congrats on your graduation, now you can get to being a mom. So all the hard work and everything that I had done was great, and that's really cute that you decided to do that, but now you can do what's important and what you're meant to be doing. Yeah.
No, I have a similar story. I got engaged the exact same summer that I got into graduate school, and I got a full ride to a PhD program. Not one person talked to me about it. They just wanted to see the ring. They just wanted to talk about the engagement. I remember, this is kind of embarrassing a little bit, but I remember I ran into a cousin of mine who were close, and I didn't tell her I was engaged. I was just like, oh God, I did a graduate program. We talked for 2 hours about, oh, that's great, we're going to live, what are you going to do? And I never told her I was engaged, because I knew if I tell her I'm engaged, no one will care about my career or that I have this thing. And she saw the engagement thing, like, on someone else's bridge, like, the next day. She's like, what? I felt like I was being deceptive. I didn't realize I was doing it on purpose. But years later, I talked to her, and I said, look, I needed that. I needed one person to care about me as a person with different life goals, and I need one person to care about that, you know? So I think we all have that. So this is one example of what we can do. A positive thing we can do to our young kids is to see them as more than a body.
Well, and you control the damage there by not even telling them.
Yeah. To see our girls as more than a body, as more than a receptacle of attraction, and to desire. And I think that's problematic as you get older too. We're all just going to get older. So if your confidence and self-worth stems from your ability to be attractive, we're setting our girls up to fail. Okay? And we're setting our boys up to progressively, hopefully, every year, they probably are a little bit better in their career, but we're setting our guys up to succeed and our girls up to fail. So we have to start switching the dialogue on what makes a woman, young women, have what we call full personhood. Full personhood means you're seen in all the areas of your life, not just as an attractive person, not just as a body, not just she's a full person. So that would be my idea, is to focus more on self-achievement independent of men, as a personhood independent of men. That would be my way to empower a woman.
I like that phrase, full personhood. I think that should be the question you ask at the end of church. So did you have to talk about your full personhood today? In what way were you a full person in church today?
Well, and you see the destructive message of full personhood, right? If you're not, like Margaret said in the argument, if you never get married, you're a half person in the church. If you never have children, if there's ways in the church where you can not achieve your full personhood, and I think we're doing that on a regular basis to our young women. Any other positive things before we open it up on bodies or attractiveness of how we can help our young women?
Maybe just acknowledging, I mean, and sexuality kind of fits in here, but that having attraction is normal, and the girls have it, like we talked about earlier about having a desire, just like men do. But, yeah, let's take some questions.
I'm curious the degree to which you guys see this, but when I was growing up in the 70s and early 80s is when I was in. Yeah, it's mostly in the early 80s. And modesty wasn't really talked about much then, but what was talked about was the importance of dressing to flatter your body. And I didn't wear immodest clothing because that was going to reveal where I was less perfect, right? I never wore sleeveless shirts because I thought my arms were fat, right? I didn't wear short shorts because my thighs were fat, right? So how can we separate out? And so that maybe our, I don't know, there's still so much body shaming, but back then there was more body shaming than there was modesty shaming, right? There wasn't modesty shaming, there was just like, you're fat, you should cover it up. So I still don't wear curly, I never wear sleeveless shirts.
You should.
Thank you.
Liberate.
Well, I mean, clearly the whole world is asking my whole naked body.
I think the area of attraction is so complicated because I think we're always in a double bind. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to be just seen as a sex object, but sometimes I like to say the only thing worse than being a sex object is not being a sex object. The more you get, the more you feel like that. And even back to like educating boys or men, you know, they're the creepy guys that tell you you're beautiful and you go, ugh. Right? But on the other hand, I feel sorry for men because sometimes, you know, I mean, one of the things that's liberating about being older like I am is that men can tell you you look good and they, it's kind of like they know that you're not going to take it sexually. And, but you know, it matters. It doesn't matter what age you are, right? I mean, you want to be attractive, right? And so it's such a double bind, and I think that's the part that is so hard. And I know for myself, in terms of, we had a fashion thing this morning, which was a great session, but this fits in too, because I've always, this sounds conceited, but I've always been a really smart woman. One of the reasons I like to dress in attractive ways is because I want to say, I'm not just a mind. You know, I'm not just a brain. You know, I'm something else too. So it gets really complicated, I think. And I feel sorry for men because it's hard for them too. I mean, I think you could be a grandfather and you see your granddaughter in a strapless evening gown and you say, you look beautiful, like your son said to you, Mom, you look beautiful. So
I think we should accept that we live with contradiction
yeah.
and irony. That's the human experience.
I just think it's sad because I have a mission call and I'm going to go to Saltillo, Mexico. And it's just hard that you have to choose. Am I going to be spiritual or am I going to be biblical? You know, it's sad that I have to be like, this is such a sacrifice that I'm going on a mission or my garments. Just how will I ever get engaged? Because I'm going to have to dress ugly, you know? Shows on TLC and you go, oh, that dress is so beautiful, but I know that my dress is going to be ugly. It shouldn't have to be separated between beauty and spirituality. It's like, you don't win no matter what you choose. And there should be a way to be like, you are beautiful because you're spiritual, or you're spiritual because you're beautiful. You know?
The worst thing you can say about a girl you wave is that she has sweet spirit.
Oh, that's, yeah.
As far as positive things to do, I was thinking about, I'm really lucky, my husband defines himself as a Muslim Mormon, so his family is from Morocco, and we get to go back and visit pretty frequently, and in thinking about positive experiences about my body, I was reminded of the first time I went to Morocco, and I had only known my mother-in-law a couple days at that point, and she woke me up in the morning and grabbed me and took me to the public bath. And I was really, really embarrassed. I was really shy, and I said, like, can I bring my swimsuit? And she didn't even understand what I was asking. But like, well, there's just women there, so don't worry. And I was still really nervous. And I went into this room, and my husband's whole family is really traditional, so it was the first time I'd seen any of them with their heads uncovered. And it was such a beautiful place to be. Like, all these naked women, and, you know, I got to see their hair for the first time, and they were helping scrub each other's backs, and just talking about our children and all these things our bodies could do, and for the first time, I didn't feel embarrassed about my body, sitting in this room full of women that I didn't know completely naked, and I think, as you were talking about, you know, I've been a young women's leader, and I've heard women disparaging their bodies, and I think one of the positive things we can do is have a space where we kind of take men out of the equation and just say, like, I love my body because of this, or not. Let our young women hear us disparaging our bodies and have a safe place where we can come together and not in a prideful way, not say I'm better than this person or that person, but just appreciate our bodies as the gift they are from God and enjoy each other as women. I mean, I love religious society and I love young women's where it's a place where it's just us. And I think that we can do more to utilize that in teaching our young women about their bodies.
I just have a question. Is there one woman in this room who didn't get up this morning and choose what she was going to wear so she would look nice today?
I knew I was walking with my side.
Is there one?
I was walking for the bike because the track station to where I was outside really there. I chose the wrong thing, so I was never.
What about you cared what you wore.
Yeah.
Well, so did I.
There are a few men here. Did you get care about what you put on today?
Sure.
Yes.
I didn't understand.
So, is that a bad thing?
No. As long as you're pleasing yourself.
No, yeah, absolutely. I like what Margaret said.
That's what we meant by cultural communication.
Yeah, other things say where she's
at. What's the motive?
What message do you want to send?
Exactly. So, I don't know if this is a question, but my daughter, my oldest daughter, is 12. She is going to women's, and I'm terrified of the messages she's going to get there. But I'm also terrified of the messages she receives in the media. I mean, she's already wanting to. She's flat-chested. She's 12. Obviously, she'll get some things later. Who knows, her family. But
she's always in cheer for us.
But
we're all in tears.
Yes. We used to it in our team, so. No, but she's already, like, she went to a young women's activity last night. It was just the girls, and they were swimming. And it was, we're in modest bathing suit. And I know she's putting little inserts in different all the other girls have something she does not. And so I'm afraid of what she's learning in church and what she's learning on TV. Where's the middle? And then just as a comment about boys that Margaret said about how we teach our boys, I have a 9 and a 5 year old boy. And since I've had this baby, I've been nursing openly in front of them. I have not been covering myself up. If somebody wants to come over to my house and I'm nursing her and you're bothered by it, you can leave. This is my house. And I've been opening about it in public as much as I can. And I'm teaching not only my daughter is it appropriate to nurse, but this is, our bodies are appropriate. There's nothing to be ashamed about. I'm feeding my child, her sister, and my 9-year-old is a little bit shyer. And so he's always, oh, let me go get your cover, Mom. But I'm trying to show him, and you know, I walk around the house and not completely naked all the time, but he's seen me naked, and I want him to know this is what a real mother looks like. This is a woman who's had 4 children. Just another way to teach them that I'm a person, I'm not just a set of body parts.
I have a question. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I'm not a man of words. And I'm trying to figure out how to communicate with my wife in another room. But I'm wondering, I like all these ideas. I'm wondering if there's any concrete examples on what I can say to her to make her feel empowered, make her feel worth, make her feel beautiful. I try to tell her she's beautiful, but I'm wondering if she thinks it's bothering her, or something else like that.
Quick thought, my husband isn't the man of words either, and he does really, really well, and he just listens. And I think if you were to just listen to your daughter, and I mean, I would do that with my dad, I would just tell my dad stuff, and even if he didn't agree with me, just the fact that he was listening to me showed me that he respected me for me and who I was. So, you know, use your strengths to your advantage.
We have one more comment, and then the panel has a bunch to say, or I guess two more comments, and then let's go back.
The only thing I can say, and I think this is just general parenting advice, but just praise me specifically, not like, you're good, or you're smart, you're beautiful, but let's let you try hard on this. I mean, you know, specifically, I like how you chose those shoes, or, you know, whatever you're going to praise her for, be specific, and it's something that she can do, or can change. Was that another comment?
I suspect that church leadership, mainly the curriculum writers, are writing about the ultra modesty, as we define it, and the extreme views that we're discussing, largely as their effort to combat the extreme in the other direction of a larger society, the unhealthiness of the flirtatious, you know, the other extreme. And so when we look at our curriculum and we see its extreme in the call it the ultra-right, it's really combating the ultra-left. Is that a fair conclusion? Secondly,
it's wrong. There's so many things. You can go ahead.
They're both accomplishing the same goal, but they're still seeing the woman's body primarily as a sexual object. The notions of the body have not been expanded on either spectrum. Do you see? So they're doing the opposite of the world, but what they're doing is sending the exact same message.
Understood. I agree with you. And so the solution might be to do something more like our guest over here has just shared. Because what children often notice is the purity that they see in the community. This woman has defined modesty. Sorry for making an example of you, but you might have defined modesty in your home in the way that you described it. And so your children will learn the healthiness of what you're conveying. And they'll eventually make comparisons with the neighbors. Let's assume follows the standard average model. And so the children will make a comparison. They may not know which is right, but the children will favor your view because you will have correctly taught them what you're, why you're doing what you're doing. So that's my point. Children tend to identify the parity, the incongruencies, rather than merely prejudicing them.
Thank you. Is there one more comment you'd like to run this whole half room? I just wanted to say, as we move towards being more body positive, I think a really important thing to remember is not because when you tie the two together, it makes priority similar to your mask or not. Are you healthy or are you unhealthy? And how do we judge that? And so I would just say that it's an interesting thing to instead embrace a way of loving bodies. Or even just engaging with your body, and being body positive might be a way to engage with your body, which can give you tools. And when you said if who didn't take the time to think about what they're wearing, I think that when we get up in the morning and we put on our clothes, we arm ourselves with multiple things. And part of that is what we wear, and that can be seen and used in certain ways, but also it isn't the number one priority. So today as a person, thanks so much. But also the other tools we have are and this kind of thing. And what you were talking about with your daughter and media literacy, I think the most important thing is to engage in sort of like what it means to engage in a culture of thinking about your body and what you put on and being a positive thing, not a negative thing, because then you can actually start to unpick what media literacy means in your life. It doesn't have to be bad versus good. So media literacy will move on positive.
So when you guys think about that eclectic jazzy outfit,
is that what you're
saying?
Beautiful,
yes, right.
So also to your question, I have a friend who says that she started complimenting herself in front of her children. And she says, do you see these lines? You only get these after a lifetime of smiling. And I love my body. And then she thought, yeah, complimenting yourself is a good way to teach your children to love themselves. I have a bunch of comments after that, but you reminded me, I have an aunt who is very down on her weight and herself, and she said she had this realization when she was looking in the mirror and saying horrible things about her body. She's a very sweet woman. She said, I would never say this to anyone else, never to a friend, never to anyone else, but I'm doing it to myself. And so she kind of helped her see, you know, we have to be just as kind to ourselves. And there's a bunch of comments here that I wanted to talk about, but I think what we're really talking about here is we need to expand the notion of what a body is. It's a healthy thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's a sexual or sensual thing. It's also just a functional thing. If we expand what the body is, then it gives the woman a full personhood. So, for example, when I talk about my body, I try to say, I love that my body has always been in so many shapes and sizes. A woman gets that through birth and childbirth. And it goes up, it goes down, and it's amazing. I think that's more miraculous as a biologist, how my body can go through these different stages. I say, I feel like I'm a 19th century, like, pioneer woman, but I've suffered dysentery, malaria, typhoid. I've had all of these diseases that haven't always been healthy. And I think, my body recovered from that. Like, it sustained me. And so I try to talk about, especially for young women or women with eating disorders, like, all the different aspects of what a body is, to just kind of expand the notion so it's not just about attractiveness or looks or, like, the kind of minute notions that we typically have. And then two last comments. I love the idea of taking men out of the equation. That was someone's comment. I think that if your woman is focused on men, the end goal being marriage, the end goal being attractive and dateable, then we are objectifying women. We are saying your job and your object is to be desirable towards someone else. And here's how we do that: with large breasts that you cover in modesty. Right? When I was at Warm High, for the 16th birthdays, two of my colleagues got breast implants, Warm Girls. Their 16th birthday, highest risk boob jobs in Utah. So we do have this culture of cover up and still be attractive, right? So we see these contradictions that these girls have to weigh, and as we get into the chastity lesson, it's the same thing.
Well, be sexy modest stuff, right?
Sexy modest.
But it's tight.
Yes. So it's like, chastity. You have to let a guy attract a guy, but don't go too far. So women are given these very contradictory messages constantly. And I think what Margaret was saying, I think the goal in life as a young woman's leader, as a father, as the state president, should be, it's not, should be, how do we get girls to stop constantly seeking out validation and approval from men? How can we teach our girls to not rely on that? How do we get them to not need validation and approval from men, but to find happiness, success, self-confidence outside of men?
Well, I think one thing is to tell them that objectification is going to happen, and then give them tools to deal with it. And look, don't teach them that they're a victim. Or, you know, men can think they're victims too. It bugs me that this new convert in my board is always picking at about the way she's always telling me to cut my hair, basically. And but instead of just feeling a victim, I can have some way to deal with it and to just some suggestions for how if a girl is treated as an object, how does she still feel empowered and not a victim? You don't know.
Well, I was just thinking, can you hear me? The main thing is just to speak up when you hear somebody say something about somebody else. And even if they're, everyone's well-meaning, so you don't need to make that person feel bad. But to say, you know, if you hear a comment from your grandma or your aunt or the neighbor about, you know, little girls wearing the sleeveless dresses or something like that, you can say, well, I'm sure it's really hot out and the weather's really hot, so they're probably just trying to keep cool. Like, if you're the person that always makes a point to speak up, and I feel like it's so important for men to do that too, especially, even more important than women. Like, my husband, he's so great about saying, if he hears another man say something, and they're saying it well-meaningly, you know, they're not doing it to be a jerk, but at work with his colleagues, if someone says, well, women were made for men, and they're just joking, he'll be like, really? Do you really think that? Because that's kind of messed up. Like, he'll say it jokingly back, but it makes that person feel kind of uncomfortable and then question, oh, yeah, what I just said, that's not really appropriate. So I think that would be a good way to start.
So we only have 15 minutes. What we're going to do is we're going to give just last comments that we prepared. We have three last subjects: chastity, life choices, and marriage, and careers. We're going to go quick. And then we're going to open it up until the very end for you guys, okay? So on chastity, we can talk about this for an entire topic. A couple of the comments I had is, when chastity is tied to worth, we're severely damaging our young women's. We deplay female sexuality in this church, and we overplay male sexuality in the church, and this leads to kind of underdeveloped sexuality in women, hyperdeveloped sexuality in men, and it causes a lot of other problems. A lot of the solutions to that are proper sex ed, and we are actually doing a combined series on Exponent and Femtoran Housewives on how to teach modesty and teach sex education throughout the years, all the way from 2 to 65. To when you get married. So hopefully look for that in the future. That would be a good resource for you. There's a million other things we can talk about. With life choices in marriage, I think the best thing that's hard, that's damaging for a young woman, is a lot of times life ends at marriage. In most young women's manuals, in most young women's rhetoric, every single step is to get you to that type of marriage. And little is talked about after that. Life is long. These young women need to know they can have a career after they have their kids. They can have a career before they have their kids. Only a portion of their life will be when they have their kids. And their life doesn't end at marriage. You know, we need to stop the rhetoric of fairy tales, happily ever after, and then we never tell the story after that. So creating sometimes a little bit longer-term goals. In regard to career, again, longer-term goals, we kind of atrophy women's brains when they're not asked the same degree as men, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because I'll tell you, how many women talk to me in their 40s and 50s and say, I just don't even know how to answer that question. Now that I can work, I have no idea what I want to do. That even if, you know, you don't teach girls to have careers, we need them to be thinking about where their talents lie, what fulfills them, what types of outside activities they would enjoy over time. So we need to ask those questions at the same rate of girls. Similarly, we need to teach our boys
that they will make sacrifices for their wife's careers. That's very rare. Most girls in the church grow up knowing, I will probably move somewhere for my husband's career. I will probably have a lower income while he finishes his school. I will probably make sacrifices to my living condition for him. Rarely, if none, of our boys ever think in their minds, what sacrifices will I be making for my wife? And even if that doesn't happen, opening that up doesn't allow that part of the brain to activate, right? It allows and opens up for possibilities. I think, absolutely.
I'm done.
My parents got divorced about 2 years ago, and I remember talking, so it may have been a long time, it wasn't happy, but I remember talking to them, and it really felt like their marriage was kind of lots of other things, but they were each given this role from the church, and because my dad believed he was in charge, he was the total boss, and whatever, that was his role, and my mom thought she should never have to work. She never wanted to, shouldn't have to. And those two roles were kind of what ruined their marriage. And I keep thinking, okay, we need to make sure we're not continuing to teach this. That men, you know, they have to be equal with their wives, and that women, yeah, have a responsibility to take care of themselves and their families, and however they want to negotiate that marriage. I think those are important principles. Also, in the chastity topic, we have so many bad object lessons. The lift cupcake, I mean, how many of you have seen, like, how many of you had a bad chastity lesson? You want to talk about this?
Yeah.
I saw a good one finally at our Feminist Mormon Girls Camp. They had a 20, it was Lisa, did it?
It was Janet,
that's right. She gave all these girls a wad up $20 bill that had like honey, and it was dropped in the mud, and somebody spit on it. It was disgusting. I mean, for her to tell it was money. And she says, well, do you want to give it back to me? And they're like, no, give me $20. She's like, well, why? Because it's still valuable. It's still valuable. It's still has worth. So I just think there's and then they got to keep the $20.
They got very often.
So if you need one, I'll make one. That's encouraging.
Do you want final comments?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Oh, I was going to comment about the roles of the church. That really put so much pressure on my marriage, too, because my wife was such a competent person and wanted a career, basically, but she didn't know how to ask for it or to or ask for the education, too. And I thought all these years, oh, if we'd only been 10 years younger, we would have given ourselves permission to trade our roles around and have a happier marriage. But I see this is still a problem. But just last night or this morning, I thought, well, maybe I should give myself permission for us to be divorced. And that this is good for her to be on her own and good for me, which I think it is, but because we come from this strong culture, it's hard to give yourself permission to say, well, maybe this is what's right for us. I have all my children are partnered, and so I'm in the grandpa stage now, and I asked my daughter what she would say on this topic. She sent me a wonderful short summary. She said, provide ample opportunities to build self-confidence and self-discovery, or allow for self-discovery. When she was growing up, she had that. She read a lot. She spent a lot of time on it. She made things with her hands. And then she's doing that with her own children. And then she says, there's spontaneous discovery and creativity. But then you have to take away their time too. And directed toward very difficult work or unpleasant work, because she feels very empowered for having done things that were very valuable and needed in our community or in other forms of work. And she knew how to work really hard. And so she's doing that with her children and deal with unpleasant things.
Are we about 5 minutes for questions or comments? Anybody?
My one comment is that a lot of you are talking about radical self-acceptance. And I don't know if you've heard the term or if anyone has anyone heard the term radical self-acceptance? Oh, it's wonderful. Something I talk to my therapist a lot about. It's what I like to call the effort plan. Because you just don't care anymore. I mean, but it's not caring. It's that you're radically accepting yourself, your body. There's a lot of literature on it, a lot of psychology literature on radical self-acceptance. It goes along with mindfulness, being very present where you are, thinking about your position, being thankful that you're where you are, doing what you can do. But it's something that I'm learning too as an older, well, young lady. I don't know. I'm 30, so I'm thinking about that a lot, and then I also want to comment. I too am a graduate student, and I thought a lot about the life of the mind and the life of the body. That's a common thing in graduate school. There's a great book called Mama PhD that talks about graduate students who are also women who are pregnant or have children or can't or decide to not have children because it doesn't fit within the graduate school timeline. And I see that bleeding into other aspects of life and friends who are not in grad school is this idea of being logical and objective is separated from this bodily. It's a male-female, it's all dichotomy, which is what we've talked about today. So I wonder if you guys had anything to say about radical self-acceptance or this dichotomy of mind and body and what that was like.
Just one comment. My colleagues like to call graduate students people who don't cut their hair, who don't get haircuts. And it is true. Like, there is an element of, if you're of the life of the mind, you can't care about what you look like because you have to, right, what Margaret was saying. So it is this interesting thing that, and I think men and women fall into it, but women particularly, that, like, what we do wear communicates so much in positive and negative ways. Like, it's impossible to get out of that. And so if we want someone to care about what our mind is, we have to look like we're not attractive. Does that make sense? And I think you find this all over the world. It's not a Mormon issue. This is, if I want students to respect me, I have to dress, talk, and look a certain way to get competence. And most men can walk in the room and have assumed competence. Yeah. And there's studies that show that. So women have a particularly difficult problem with cultural communication because it's so strongly biased in the negative.
I think that it's empowering for children, right? And I have a 24, I have 7 children, and I do feel like as a mother, I would have been happier working part-time, and I tried, but God sent me before I hit them at the age of 3. So it was like, this is where you belong. And, but then I had 3, and then I moved to Utah, and I prayed with the first guy I moved here, and I had 3 more. So it's like, but I do, I regret the time that I didn't stay in some kind of career part-time. So I want to know, you being from Orem, I wondered if you were from Draper, you know, you talked about foods. I'm from Park City. I guess there's the money up there, but there is not the
classics.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And and I like the diversity, because I was raised in California. It feels more like my cousin calls it Park City, California. So my question to you is, being raised in Orem, where did you find the know-how and the power to make your career a priority along with children and marriage?
That's an excellent question. He's Chelsea Stans at CES.
Yeah. My institute director taught me you were lived in very conservative and almost stay at home mom. I don't know. I know when I was 5, I said, I want to be
This is my parents' way here, 5 years old. He said, no, you can be the president's wife. You need to be a mom. You can't, who's going to raise your kids? And I was feeling so dejected at kindergarten, being like, God, I'm smarter than all the boys in my class. Why does he get to be president? And I said, not me. And I remember that being in my father, even at a young age.
Born feminist girl.
Born feminist girl. And I remember feeling like that was wrong. So for my whole life, I felt like that's not fair. So I lived my life, and that's not fair. It's not fair that the boys are going to go home first. It's not fair. You know, I'm from a very adolescent perspective. But I don't know, it's always been there, but it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been easy to find someone who would support my career to marry. It's near impossible. You know, it hasn't been easy to find, you know, at Boston University, professors who think it's okay that I'm having children in the middle of the prime of my career. So I don't know that answer. I wish I had it, other than I was born thinking that's not fair.
Alright, well, there's one more question.
We have a secret weapon, and I want to talk to the women over 60 in the room, because I think grandmas are fabulous. When you say, what do you do as a dialogue for your young women? I just spent a week with my children, my grandchildren, we take them on a banana trip. Papa and Anna. Okay, so it's banana. And my two granddaughters are 12 and 14. And online, Jonathan had posted a thing about the questions for young women. Did you guys, anybody see that? All the questions and the responding answers to all these questions. It's amazing. You look it up and read it, what to see where your young women are at. And we went down every question and the answer, and we spent the whole evening talking about that. And when I told their mother, sometimes mothers and daughters can't do this, but grandmas can. You know, and then I always think the best way to teach a happy life is to role model it. And so if you role model healthy images, and that, and I think if you get it from your grandma, you grannies go. We go, we walk.
I have self-respect for my grandma. My grandma's an asshole.
Just
my grandma's an asshole. Well, thank you all so much for coming to our session.
Thank you.